welcome to a Juno afternoon here on Monday, August 18th, 2014. This is Scott Burton filling in for Joan Pardis. Today we'll hear from City Manager Kim Kiefer. She'll bring us up to date on what's going on in the CBJ. Author Debbie Miller will be here to talk about a book she co-wrote with John Eiler called A King Salmon Journey. We'll hear about the book, signings and talks throughout the week. And the Juno Recovery Community Organization's Katie Chapman will be here to tell us about Juno's Got Recovery event this Saturday at Sandy Beach. Those interviews, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more right here on the Juno Afternoon. Here's National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Sarah Gustavus. The U.S. Department of Justice has joined a federal lawsuit in Rapid City, South Dakota. The suit alleges that Seventh Circuit Court judges, the Pennington County State's Attorney, and the State Department of Social Services removed children for as long as 60 days without giving tribes and parents a fair hearing. Victoria Wicks reports that tribal officials from the Rosebud and Pine Ridge reservations, along with parents, say the defendants are violating the Indian Child Welfare Act, or ICWA.
In its friend of the court filing, the Department of Justice notes that ICWA and Department of Interior guidelines require that child custody proceedings occur quickly, and the state return children to their homes as soon as the danger of physical damage or harm has been resolved. State law requires that a hearing be held within 48 hours of a child's removal from a home, but plaintiffs say those hearings are frequently meaningless as conducted in Pennington County. Plaintiff's attorney Dana Hanna says transcripts show that hearings are brief, sometimes just a couple of minutes long, and that parents, tribes, and their attorneys don't have an opportunity to present evidence or testimony to refute the state's allegations.
We submitted about 50 transcripts of those hearings to prove that state defendants are not giving Indian parents a meaningful or fair hearing before they take their kids.
Hanna says on the strength of that evidence, plaintiffs have asked Judge Jeffrey Viken for summary judgment. If the judge finds there are no disputes of fact, he can make a ruling without a trial. The Department of Justice submitted a 23-page brief that included research to assist the plaintiff's case. Dana Hanna explains.
The Department of Justice has an interest in seeing to it that federal laws are correctly interpreted and obeyed. And basically they conclude that South Dakota officials, the defendants in this case, are incorrectly interpreting the Indian Child Welfare Act, as well as the requirements of constitutional due process, which basically means fundamental fairness.
Defendants have until August 29th to respond to plaintiff's motion for summary judgment. Defendants' attorneys declined to comment on pending litigation. For National Native News, I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City, South Dakota.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture is making $6 million in federal grant money available to encourage rural development. Grants will go to nonprofit groups for technical and financial help to build up housing, community buildings, and various economic development projects. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Gary Ellenbolt reports.
The competitive grants are meant to improve economic development and quality of life in rural areas of the U.S. Elsie Meeks directs South Dakota's USDA Rural Assistance Program. She says several tribes have been able to benefit from these grants.
In this last year, for instance, Grow South Dakota received one for about $152,000 that it was really based on a South Dakota Native Home Ownership Coalition. So the coalition is made up of a bunch of members that are trying to promote home ownership on reservations.
Meek says the deadline for grant applications is November 12th, but she says applications should be into the state office well before that. For National Native News, I'm Gary Ellenbold.
The Native Cinema Showcase kicks off today in Santa Fe, New Mexico. The showcase is organized by the National Museum of the American Indian and the Southwestern Association for Indian Arts, known as SWAIA. It's part of the annual Santa Fe Indian Market. This year's showcase will feature over 20 feature-length and short films. Winners of this year's Classification X competition will also be featured in screenings. The film Incident at Oglala will be screened on Monday, and John Trudell is scheduled to attend. Panel discussions with filmmakers and actors will give viewers a chance to discuss the work, and educators' workshops will be held throughout the week. For National Native News, I'm Sarah Gustavus.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation, and by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C.
Our democracy is a government of the people, for the people. Let's keep it that way. Vote on November 4th. Get registered, cast your vote. It's that simple. More information at nativenews.net. Brought to you by the Carnegie Corporation of New York and Kawanak Broadcast Corporation.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Service.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Monday, August 18th, 2014. Scott Burton standing in for Joan Pardis. With me now in the studio is City Manager Kim Kiefer. Welcome to the studio, Kim.
Thank you, Scott.
Thanks for walking over. I think it stopped raining a little
bit. It did. Yeah, the walk from City Hall was easy. I didn't have to have my hood up. It was great.
Great. Well, welcome. It's nice to have you here today. Kim, I thought, why don't we start today by telling us a little bit about what the city manager does? I know you've done it before, but refresh us and maybe give us a little comparison to say how you compare to the mayor, for example.
Okay, sure. So we have what we call a strong city manager form of government here, which is different than what Anchorage has. So Anchorage has a strong assembly form of government or strong council form of government. So for me, I have 9 bosses, which is the assembly, and they appoint the city manager and they appoint the city attorney. So the assembly has 2 employees.
Okay, and you're one of them.
And I'm one of them. I'm one of 2.
Who's your favorite boss?
They all are. All 9 of them.
Good answer.
All 9 of them. And so my job is to, the assembly does policy, and my job is to implement their policy and with recommendations on how to tweak that so it can be the most efficient and effective for everybody. Some people think the assembly directs other staff, and so they'll go to them with concerns about staff, and those concerns get forwarded back to me saying, okay, here's what the situation is. Can you follow up on it? Which is different than the mayor or other assembly members.
Okay.
The mayor is the one that coordinates the meeting, runs the meeting for the assembly, specifically the assembly meeting. So, like tonight, we have a committee of the whole, but that is run by the deputy city or deputy mayor runs that meeting instead of the mayor. So, the different committees of the assembly have different people that chair those committees.
Okay.
And so, the mayor he helps set policy, helps set direction of where, with the rest of the assembly, where they're going to go. He also does a lot of the reach out to other communities.
Okay.
You know, working with our sister cities in Whitehorse, working with other mayors throughout Southeast Alaska. He works very much with Southeast Conference. So he reaches out broader than I do. I tend to focus more on just Juneau, although I do work with city managers throughout the state on different things. But for the most part, my focus is Juneau operations and all of those things that make up those Juneau operations.
I see. Good explanation. Thank you.
Sure.
Yeah. All right. So you said some things like community of the whole.
Committee of the Whole.
Committee of the Whole, excuse me. That's happening tonight.
Correct.
How does that differ from a normal assembly meeting?
Great question. So the Committee of the Whole really is the assembly's option. It's like a work session for the assembly.
Okay.
It gives them opportunity to question things, to have staff there to be able to answer things, and work it out before it moves to the full assembly for action. So when it goes to the assembly, it's an action item for the assembly to take action on one way or another. In the Committee of the Whole, they can say, you know what, I still have some more questions here, and can we schedule this again so that we can have more information and understand this better to be able to move it forward.
Okay.
So it's a really good opportunity that for them to get into the details of it, dig into it, get all their questions answered so that they then will know about it when it comes to the assembly meeting, instead of doing all those questions and answers there, which could be frustrating because for the assembly meeting, we give people notice for ordinances. So there's what we call a consent agenda that has all the ordinances for introduction. And so what that basically is notifying the public that at the next assembly meeting, we're going to take public hearing on all of those ordinances. And so then the public hearing comes up, the public has their say, and if the assembly has a lot of questions and then they kick it back, then back to a committee to work on some more, then the public will have to come back again to be able to provide comment. So the benefit of the committee, the whole or other committees that the assembly has, is to do that work, forward it to the assembly, hopefully has all, at least all the assembly's questions answered. The public may still bring up questions at the assembly meeting, and the assembly may say, you know what, we want to get more information on that, so can we refer it back to committee to do additional work? So most recently where that's happened is with the wireless ordinance, that the assembly went through committees, went to the assembly, there were still some questions, and so it was referred back to committee to be able to work on it some more before it's ready to bring back forward to the assembly for action.
All right. Thanks for another good explanation.
Sure.
So what's on your radar these days? What do you want to talk about today?
What's on our let's see. Well, the big thing, of course, tomorrow is getting everybody out to vote.
Yes.
It's critical.
Absolutely.
Live in a place where our vote counts, and it's really important to have that vote out there. Our past last year's election
19%?
Was 19%.
Ouch.
I know, Juno, we can do a lot better than that. And it's an interesting year because we have the election tomorrow, we have another one in October, we have another one in November. So we are stacking up this year on elections. But it's really important to get out there, and it's important, bring your kids along or at least talk to them about the election so they understand why you get to make these choices and how you go about that process, so that they will then become engaged as they get voting age.
And it's an interesting coalition of organizations, right, that's part of Juno Votes.
Yes.
Some media organizations, and even your office is involved. What are you all doing as part of it?
Mostly what we're doing is getting the information out about Juno Votes,
mm-hmm.
And so it is. It's a wide variety of groups getting together, and a lot of what Juno Votes is doing is trying to advertise what events are already happening out there. So usually the League of Women Voters does an interview process with candidates. This year Juno Votes is working with the media to have those interviews happen as well.
Mm.
So people have different opportunities to be able to hear what the candidates think about different issues, and ask from different areas of the community. Juno Votes also was very engaged in trying to get people registered to vote, making sure people were registered, making sure people knew where they needed to vote. So it will be interesting to see at the end. I sure hope that we're above 19 percent for our local election.
We can do it, Juno.
Yeah, we can. We easily can. And it's, there's important issues that everybody needs to have their say on.
Absolutely.
And it's an opportunity that there's some places don't get that opportunity, so you really need to use that.
Okay, so Juno Votes. What mm-hmm. else are you working on?
I'm continuing to work on budget.
Mm.
As many of your listeners know, we had a $6 million deficit for FY15. We have a $9.2 million deficit for FY16. Of the reductions that we made in FY15, approximately $2 million of that will go into 16. So really we're looking at a number now that's about $7.2 million. So we've got a number of committees that are looking at a variety of different things, reorganization of and restructuring of city government, looking at how we buy equipment and replace our rolling fleet. And then the assembly has a committee that the mayor has appointed, the sales tax exemption committee, and they're looking at all the exemptions. And so they've had three meetings now to look at the exemptions. And right now what they're getting is a lot of data.
Mm.
What are the numbers that go with these different exemptions? What are the questions they have? So continuing to get that information. And those committee meetings have been happening on Thursday nights. There's a link off of juno.org that can get you caught up on what they've done over the last couple meetings and get that information. So a lot of my focus right now still is looking at that $7.2 million deficit that we have to make up.
Seems to me like that would be brutal work, right, is figuring out a deficit. But at the same time, you might be able to, like you said, figuring out new ways to buy machinery mm-hmm. and streamlining things and making them more efficient. How is that process going for y'all?
You know, it's challenging to have people. One, change is hard for people. So that's off the top is difficult for people. The other thing is people get used to doing things the same way. And so to have people stop and think about, why am I doing it this way?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the thing I tell people time and time again is a story about a granddaughter and ham. So this granddaughter forever watched her grandmother cook ham. And so she would sit at the kitchen table and watch Grandma cook up the ham. And Grandma would always cut the ends off the ham and put it in the pan and put it in the oven. And so as Grandmother got older, the granddaughter's like, okay, I'm going to cook Grandma's ham. So Grandma came over for dinner, and the granddaughter cut the ends off and put it in the pan and put it in the oven. And Grandma looked to her granddaughter and said, why did you cut the ends off? And she said, and the granddaughter said, Grandma, you always did that. As I was a kid, I watched you. You always cut the ends off of it and put it in the pan and put it in the oven. And the grandmother said, I did that because that was the size of pan I had. And so I think that's a really good way for people to think about, why are they doing what they're doing? Are they doing it because it's the way they've always done it? Or are they doing it because it's the best way to do it?
Mm.
And so trying to get people to take that minute to stop and think, okay, is there a different way to do this?
Sure.
At least ask the question. And so that's what I'm encouraging everybody to do. Ask the question in all areas of our organization.
Mm.
Because everybody can have great ideas. You know, there's also it sounds weird, sort of a level of excitement that can come with this, because you can think outside the box.
Innovation.
Look at different ways of doing things.
Sure.
Yeah.
And some traditions are great and you keep them when mm-hmm. they're working, they're effective.
Yes.
But some can be streamlined, like you said.
Yeah. It doesn't mean just because you ask the question that you're going to do it differently, but you need to ask the question to understand really why this has been passed down.
Mm.
Is it, you know, technology's changed. You know, what we're looking at now compared to what we were looking at 10 years ago or even 3 years ago is so different.
Right.
And so, yeah, it still may be the best way to do it, but at least ask that question.
Okay. So Juno votes, budgetary stuff. What else?
What else?
Transit plan?
Transit plan. We adopted the transit development plan in April, or the assembly adopted it
okay.
in April. And there had been a lot of public meetings. The goal of the transit development plan was to expand transit to Riverside Drive. When the transit plan was adopted, we said it would cost us $200,000 more to implement that plan. Of course, that was April, and then we rolled into budget, and we realized that we were going to have to make reductions. And so we ended up reducing the capital transit budget by $100,000. So we're in a position now of trying to implement the plan with really about $300,000 less. So how do we do that? So we have been looking at a number of different schedules. We gave the drivers the schedule about a week and a half ago, a draft schedule. They had a lot of comments on it, a lot of concerns about it. They put together a very thorough memo to the assembly for the assembly committee the whole tonight, because we'll be
Great.
Talking about the transit plan, and they were very articulate on the issues that they had and the concerns that they had, and so we met with them last night and talked to the drivers, and they chose last night because it was when the drivers were all off and they could attend. So we met with them starting at 7:30 last night. They had an agenda. They had questions for us. And I hope everybody walked away with this is still a work in progress,
okay,
or a process. We don't have an end result at this point. We're continuing to work towards a refined system. We need their input. We want their input on what can work. And so when the new system will change, we need to work out, we need to get a system and a schedule that we can put out to the public, so the public can also respond to it, and then we'll know when we can implement it. So we were hoping that we may be able to implement something in October. I don't know that that's realistic at this point. We really need to make sure it's a system that can work, that can still access Riverside Drive, which was a big push of this new system, because we have so many public facilities now on Riverside Drive. We want to be able to have people have access to that. We also wanted people to have access to university. We want to try and have people have access for working hours, and working hours aren't always 8 to 4:30. One of the things that we looked at in the original plan was to try and access up into the Lemon Creek area, and we realized that that's got to be a future item that we will look at. It won't be something we can look at in this one. So what we're trying to do for the revised plan now is still trying to provide some access to Riverside, be able to look at expanding the system a little bit for that Riverside, and also look at maybe expanding the hours. But it's, like I said, it's a work in progress, and hopefully by the end of the year we'll have a new system in place, or new schedule in place.
Okay, and is there a superintendent search going on?
There is.
Okay, how's that going?
Not well. We've had to open it up a number of times. So we're continuing to try and find a new transit superintendent. We're looking at what we're paying and compared to other places, and I think we're low on that. On the flip side, we have a system that's got really high ridership. People are very engaged in it, so it could be really exciting for somebody to come here. So we're looking at, are we not getting it out to the right market? What are the pieces? Because we've had it open for almost 2 months, I think, and just haven't got a good applicant pool. So we're continuing to work on that one.
Okay. Good luck on that.
Thank you.
I think I told you this last time you were here, but kudos to all of you for getting express service on the hour and half hour out to the university and back. That was just wonderful.
Thank you.
Yes.
Let's hope we'll see how the new schedule, how that it may adjust.
Oh.
Everything's being looked at.
All right. We have some hikes in water and sewer prices coming up, I think.
We do, and they will take place January 1st.
Okay.
And I don't, off the top of my head, have the number, the change number from what it is to what it's going to. But it will, there was interest in doing it earlier, and the assembly said, you know what, let's give people time. Mm-hmm. Know this is coming, so it will happen January 1st.
And what was the inspiration? Maybe that's the wrong word, but what motivated these changes?
Well, we looked at all the capital improvement projects that we need to do for water and wastewater, and we looked at the amount of money that we had and realized that in a list for the next 10 years that totaled close to $75 million, that we couldn't do it with the rates that we had.
Okay.
And rates aren't the only thing that we look to. We look to getting grants or loans or other kind of funding to be able to do these projects. But given the rates that we had with the work that needs to be done, we've got an old system. A lot of our system was installed in the 70s, and so we're starting to turn that over, and so you have larger costs. And so we needed to have money in place to be able to take care of those ongoing needs.
Okay. Anything else on your radar that you'd like to talk about today, Kim?
One thing that's constantly that we've been working on over the last 6 months, 7 months, is the Juneau Economic Development Plan. And so that is a goal of the assembly to have that completed by the end of the year. At the Committee of the Whole meeting tonight at 6 o'clock, we will have McDowell Group and Scheinberg Associates, who are our contractors for the economic development plan. They'll be there. They've done a lot of surveying, and they have that behind them now. And now they're really digging into, okay, what are the things that we're going to line out? By the end of the year, they will have a punch list, really, of things that can be done. And what can the city do? What can others do? Because it's really about Juneau as a community. It's not all about city government doing it. There's pieces that everybody can take in that. So that's exciting. It will be really nice to have that plan to go forward with, to look at potentially capital improvement projects that we need to change, or other things, and what will those other things be. So that, I encourage people to go to Juneau.org. You can get the link to the economic development plan off of there. You can see the research that they've done and the surveys that they've done and where they are in the process.
All right, Kim, well, thank you for coming in today.
Thank you.
Are we missing anything?
There's always plenty to do, so I think we've hit the highlights. People know we've got a Committee of the Whole meeting tonight at 6 o'clock. And we've got an assembly meeting next Monday. Juneau.org is where you can go. There's a great little link on the bottom right-hand corner. It's a little calendar, and you can find out all the different meetings that are going on in city government. And remember, tomorrow,
vote.
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 Thank you
so much for your time,
Thank
Kim.
You, Scott.
Get along with that steel driving coup. I went to the captain, said I need a job, said I need a job, and he said, son, track. I can blow the jack, and I can pick a shovel too. Working boss, you're the boss, but I don't belong to you.
And welcome back to a Juno Afternoon here on Monday, August 18th, 2014. Scott Burton here in the studio, sitting in for Joan Pardis. With me now in the studio is Debbie Miller. Let me turn you on there. Debbie, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you, Scott?
I'm great. Thanks for coming in today.
It's wonderful to be here.
And we also have John Eiler in the studio. Welcome to the studio, John.
Thanks.
And you two collaborated on a book called A King Salmon Journey, which you're holding right over there, Debbie.
Right. Amazing project and amazing research on the part of John. You know, great five-year study. And we were able to pick a very special fish out of this research project, which we called Chinook in the story. And this is a true story of a fish that swam the farthest of all of the fish that were tagged in his study. 2,007 miles, 63 days up the Yukon River without eating. And thanks to some amazing research that he has done on these fish, which he can talk more about, it developed into quite a story, tracing it in real time.
And, John, we were just talking about it a little bit outside, but tell me again how this whole thing started. It's a great story.
Well, I've done this type of work for a number of years, and when I first started, my two sons were younger, and I was gone a lot during the summer. So when we'd call or when I'd come home, I'd tell them stories about the fish. So the first two fish we tagged, this was a tagging study where we would capture the adult fish as they came back to the river and were swimming up to where they'd spawn. And we would put radios on the fish and be able to then track them as they moved upriver. And so I'd always name one after my older son, Weston, and one Luke after my younger. And so I'd tell them the stories. Mm-hmm. Well, when we were doing work up on the Yukon, one of the pilots I was flying with was Debbie's husband. And one time I was over at their house, and Debbie and I started talking, and she was asking about the study, and I was saying, yeah, and then it came out she was a children's author, and I was going, oh, well, this would make a great story.
It really would.
When I heard about this research that he could put this little transmitter inside the stomach of a fish, which wouldn't hurt the fish because they don't eat on this long migration up the Yukon River, and that all of this data was going to be, you know, inside this little bullet, the depth that they're swimming, the water temperature, and that all of these little towers that are set up along the Yukon where the signal would beam to the tower, and then the tower would uplink it to a satellite, and then, you know, you could, you know, day by day know exactly where this fish was swimming and how fast and how deep. I thought, kids are going to love this stuff.
Yeah.
And so
it's going to be super educational as
super
well.
Super educational. I mean, imagine.
Entertaining.
This fish is swimming through turbid water most of the way, can't see. And it's a, you know, 5-6 mile an hour current.
Wow.
And, you know, when it gets to the halfway point, a little beyond halfway, suddenly something changes. I'll read you a little section here. Chinook feels a distinct change in pressure and current. She swims blindly and slowly through thick clouds of powdery silt that coat her gills as she struggles to breathe. Chinook powers through the confluence of the Yukon and the White River. This huge tributary dumps millions of tons of silt into the Yukon. Each summer, the immense glaciers of the Wrangell and St. Elias Mountains move, carve, and grind the rock beneath them. The steady rush of melting ice causes tremendous erosion. Suddenly, the clouds of silt disappear as Chinook surges beyond the murky White River. The Yukon is clear. Chinook's keen eyes spot other fish in the river. Arctic grayling feed at the mouth of a creek. A northern pike lunges at a small whitefish, while a huge black burbot lingers beneath a submerged log.
Don't stop.
But just imagine, this fish is not only swimming over 2,000 miles, most of the way, it can't see, you know, it's just this turbid.
Against the current.
Against the current. And then suddenly it gets past the White River and everything is clear, and then he's got a nice kind of clear stream that he ends up, or she ends up spawning in, which I floated down.
Wow.
For 2 weeks. I went to the spawning area of this particular fish that's in the story. And I floated down the what's called the Nazutlin River that flows into the Teslin, which flows into the Yukon. And so I actually got to see that exact route where this particular female swam and then deposited her eggs, built her red.
Sounds like a wonderful research project, a wonderful part of your research.
Well, it was great to experience that, just like when John's out, you know, putting the tag inside the fish and retrieving that tag, which I bet you have probably a story or two.
Oh, just a few.
And you have one of the radio's transmitters with you, right? Can you, for our listening audience, can you describe what we're looking at?
Yeah, basically it looks, it's about the size of someone's thumb. It's coated with a very smooth electronic resin, which won't react with the body of the fish, and has an antenna coming out the top. And what we would do, since the fish weren't feeding as they travel up the river, when we capture the fish, we'd get them out of the net, and then, again, we used nets that were very soft mesh, so that the fish wouldn't be injured, because we're trying to get the fish to act like a untagged fish would do. We don't want to hurt them in any way. But so we'd put them in a tagging cradle, and then we'd gently, filled with water, and then we'd gently open the mouth and just slide it right down into the stomach. And people are going, oh, yeah, that's what a strange place. But you go, no, it's perfect, because here's fast-moving current. Here's a fish that's hydrodynamically shaped, and you don't want anything on the outside to interfere with its movement. And so here this tag is sitting on the inside. It's a perfect place. And what really allowed us to do then was to be able to track the movements of fish up into the different parts of the drainage. And some of the work we've done have been in these rivers where they're huge drainages. They're remote, so that it's hard to get to. And, you know, there are a lot of things we didn't know about the returns of fish. And so, you know, this radio telemetry was one of the tools that allowed us to begin to get a handle on the run characteristics of the fish.
And you mentioned, too, that the fish stop eating once they get to fresh water. Mm-hmm. Is that I've heard that before. Most of their feeding is done by, like, out in the Bering Sea, for example, right, in the seawater, and then once they're heading upstream, it's no moss.
Yeah. And that surprised me, too. I thought, swimming so far, they have to eat something, you know. And
so fast, too. The fish that we were tracking actually, you know, for most of its trip upriver, it was going over 35 miles an hour.
What?
For a 60-day period. And
not even.
Or 35 miles a day, right?
I'm sorry.
A day, yeah.
I was going to say. You're right.
fast fish.
that would really be fast. But no, it was.
Still, 35 miles a day against a current like that. And then the interesting thing, too, you discovered was some fish swim faster than other fish. Like the fish that go up the Klondike were the fastest, right? Yeah. They swam, and they were, that's considerable distance beyond Dawson. And for some unknown reason, they really, really hightail it.
Well, this sounds like a really fun project. What have been some of the challenges for you as you put this together?
Well, the challenge is probably trying to fit everything that we wanted to fit in the context of a picture book, because we wanted teachers to have the science data. And so as you read through the book, every time you turn the page, you know, where the fish is, what mile it's on, how fast it's swimming, how deep it's swimming, what the water temperature is. We wanted all of that to fit along with a map that would show kids, you know, where is this fish on this journey? What's happening? And that took a lot of work on design and working with University of Alaska Press, the publisher. They did a great job with the graphics on the design to show all that science data that, you know, John has worked so hard on.
Well, one thing that I think Debbie did really well was you can take this book, and for younger audiences, they can just read through it. And it's a fun story. But because the way that's set out with some of the information, like a teacher could take this and say, hey, there's certain things we could learn from what the fish is doing. Look at how the speed is changing or the temperature's changing. You know, and all that's kind of built into the story, but not in a way that if, you know, for younger ages, they could just read through it and just say, oh, that's a great story.
Got it. And speaking of younger ages, teachers and kids and students, what would you say is the target audience for this book?
I'd say third and fourth grade, you know, reading level for sure. But younger children could enjoy it too, you know, going through the wonderful illustrations of John Van Zyl. You know, we've worked together now for 20 years.
Wow.
This is our 11th book. He's a fabulous illustrator, and I think, you know, the colorful illustrations and the way he portrays the fish and the people that use the fish along the river, which I found fascinating that we have Yupik Eskimos and Koyukon Athabascan and Gwich'in Athabascan and Tlingit people that are interior Tlingit people that are living around Teslin Lake. All these fish, I mean, that go up the Yukon are utilized by these different cultures.
And that's included in your book, all this information.
It is, yeah. Wow. And that was fascinating to see a resource that is used by so many people that is so important that are in that watershed. So that's part of the story,
Absolutely.
Too.
Absolutely. That's fascinating. So you're here in town. I know you came in this morning. John, you live here, right?
Yep.
And you did a reading today already, so I think we missed one. But you have one tomorrow, is that right?
We'll be at the Nugget Mall tomorrow evening from 6 to 7:30, and okay. We'll be there to show some of the wonderful tools that John uses in his research, you know, how he tracks these fish, which might be interesting for kids to see. The actual tag that is put inside the fish, we'll have that with a little antenna. And do a short talk on it tomorrow at the Nugget Mall at Hearthside.
6 to 7:30.
And then the next evening from 6:30 to 8:30 at Silver Bowl, the Alaska Wilderness League is hosting a gathering with refreshments, light refreshments, and we'll be giving a short discussion about the making of this book.
Fun.
And the community is invited, particularly if people are interested in learning more about the conservation work that the league is doing. I serve on their board.
Okay.
And the board is in town. Staff is in town. We'd love to meet people in Juneau who care about salmon, who care about, you know, the tongass, you know, some of the issues that we work on that specifically pertain to Alaska's public lands and protecting the resources.
Great. So that's Saturday, 6:30 to 8:30.
That's a Wednesday.
Oh, Wednesday. Sorry, from
this Wednesday from 6:30 to 8:30 at the Silver Boat.
Not sure what will be going on there Saturday, but this is on Wednesday.
People will be fishing on Saturday
right?
You know, with the sun will be out by Saturday.
I know. Have you seen the weather?
Keeping our fingers crossed.
Well, it's been nice talking to you about this. Is there something you'd like to add? Anything we're missing?
Well, the only thing I would add maybe is that by doing this book and learning about salmon.
Mm-hmm.
I have this amazing respect for this creature that I didn't have before. And I just feel like as an Alaskan and as a community, whether you live in Russian Missions on the lower Yukon or whether you live in Fort Yukon or Juneau, this is such an important resource for our state, you know, to protect the watersheds that we have that are so vital. And, you know, into the reading that I did, we've lost so many salmon runs around the world because we've lost the habitat or we've mismanaged on the fisheries as far as the catch, you know, the seasonal catch. And Alaska is so special because the habitat's intact. Mm-hmm. And we don't have dams, you know, where like on the Columbia, these poor fish have to go around, 18 or more dams, you know.
Sure.
And that was a wonderful story and a celebration for our salmon of Alaska, that we can protect that resource and have them for the future. And so,
good.
Cheers to the salmon, I guess, is what I would say.
And just that once, I want to ask you that, John, what was the most fulfilling part of this project for you?
Well, you know, to me it was very enjoyable to, you know, we do a lot of scientific research. It was very enjoyable to kind of put it into a framework where, you know, readers of all ages could kind of look at it and really enjoy it. But I'd kind of also echo some of what Debbie said is one of, you know, having worked on a number of scientific projects, you know, they're all very interesting and science is just an amazing thing as you get into the biology of fishes and what they do or don't do. But one of the things that really made this project really special was not only, you know, the biology, which was interesting, and the scenery, which was just gorgeous, you know, throughout interior Alaska, but also the fact that we were working and meeting people that that were really dependent on the salmon, were interested, and you know how the information we were collecting could be used to kind of help manage the resource and facilitate conservation efforts when needed.
All right, John Eiler, Debbie Miller, their book is A King Salmon Journey. Tomorrow night at the Nugget Hearthside, 6 to 7:30, and Wednesday at the Silver Bow from 6:30 to 8:30. Check it out. Thanks, you two, for your time.
No, thank you, Scott.
You.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday, the 18th of August, 2014. It's the birthday of the French virologist Luc Montagnier, born 1932 near Tours. Got interested in science when he was very young because of his father, who was an amateur scientist. In the 60s and 70s, he got interested in a possible link between retroviruses and cancer. And when the AIDS epidemic hit in the early 80s, Dr. Montagnier applied his retrovirus research to a search for the cause of the syndrome and isolated a virus that was present in patients with a pre-AIDS condition of persistent swollen lymph nodes. They call it LAV, lymphadenopathy-associated virus, later renamed HIV, human immunodeficiency virus. And once they'd isolated the virus, they could develop a test for it. Luc Montagnier and his colleagues were awarded the Nobel Prize in 2008. It was on this day, 1958, Vladimir Nabokov's Lolita was published in the United States. It had come out in France 3 years before by a publisher that specialized in erotica. The story of a middle-aged man, Humbert Humbert, and his obsession with his landlady's 12-year-old daughter. Graham Greene loved it. E.M. Forster, Evelyn Waugh, Edmund Wilson did not. In a postscript, Nabokov wrote, "Once or twice I was on the point of burning the unfinished draft when I was stopped by the thought that the ghost of the destroyed book would haunt my files for the rest of my life." And it was on this date in 1920 the 19th Amendment to the Constitution was ratified, giving women the right to vote. The women's suffrage movement arose in the 19th century hand-in-hand with the abolitionist movement. 1848, Women's Rights Convention, Seneca Falls, New York, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Lucretia Mott. And in the latter half of the 19th century, gradually states began loosening restrictions on voting rights for women. Wyoming, the first state to grant women the full right to vote, 1890. 1919, the constitutional amendment passed. Both houses of Congress was sent to the states for ratification, and on August 18, 1920, it all came down to Tennessee. The legislature tied 48-48, and it all came down to one person, Harry Byrne, 24 years old, the youngest state legislator, who had been expected to vote against it, but his mother wrote him a note and said, "Be a good boy and help Mrs. Catt put the rat in ratification," and he voted yes. Here's a poem by Robert Bly, "The Cabbages of Chekhov." Some gamblers abandon carefully built houses in order to live near water. It's all right. One day on the river is worth a thousand nights on land. It is our attraction to ruin that saves us, and disaster, friends, brings us health. Chekhov shocks the heavens with his dark cabbages. William Blake knew that fierce old man, irritable, chained, and majestic, who bends over to measure with his calipers the ruin of the world. It takes so little to make me happy tonight. 4 hours of singing will do it if we remember how much of our life is a ruin and agree to that. Butterflies spend all afternoon concentrating on the buddleia bush. Human beings take in the fragrance of a thousand nights of ruin. We planted fields of sorrow near the Tigris. The harvesters will come in at the end of time and tell us that the crop of ruin has been great. Robert Bly's poem, "The Cabbages of Chekhov," from "The Night Abraham Called to the Stars," published by HarperCollins, used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Kathy Roach. Be well, do good work, keep in touch.
Hi. Hi, this is Dennis Travis, your host for Strings Attached on KRNN 102.7 FM, and that's on Monday nights, 9 to 11. I listen to KRNN for my music pleasure because of the wide variety. They have bluegrass, Americana, rock and blues, and they don't play the same thing over and over. So tune in to KRNN 102.7 FM. Thank you.
Here we are in a Juno afternoon here on Monday, August 18th, 2014. Scott Burton here sitting in for Joan Pardis. And with me now in the studio is Katie Chapman. Welcome, Katie.
Hello.
And Kara Nelson. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Hello.
Did I say it right? Is it Kara or Kara?
Yes, Kara.
All right. And Kara, you are the director of the Haven House. Is that correct?
Yes.
Why don't you tell us, well, actually, before we get into that, let's talk about the event, and then we'll break it down a little bit.
Okay.
So you two are here to tell us about an event this Saturday. Katie,
yes.
Tell us, what is it? It's the Juno
It's Recovery Fest 2014.
All right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So Recovery Fest 2014, the theme is Juno's Got Recovery.
Yeah. Okay.
Because we do. There's like at least 3,000 people in Juno who have recovery. And it's going to take place at Savico Park, which is Sandy Beach in Douglas, from noon to 7.
Okay.
And the event is, it's just a day of fun to celebrate life and recovery and connect with family and friends. Bring your children. There's a nice playground there, right?
I hear the weather's going to be nice.
I think it's going to be good. We've got a barbecue, free food.
Yes.
What else? Live music, Curly J and the Wrist Rockets. Will be there,
okay.
As well as Terry Tibbett.
All right.
And we've got a dunk tank, so hopefully there will be some interesting volunteers that will be willing to be dunked. And what else do we have? We have an open mic for people to share some stories or poetry, whatever they like. And we're going to be giving out some awards, just recognizing some people in the recovery community and in our community who support recovery.
Okay. And you two are both part of the recovery community.
Yes.
And, Kara, you're director of Haven House. Can you tell us a little bit about Haven House and also how you're connected with the recovery community?
Well, Haven House is a home that we're trying to open here in Juneau for women coming out of prison, for women who have already made the decision that they want to be in recovery and have already made steps towards that life in recovery. So we're going to be a supportive place there with peer support as well. There'll be up to 9 women there. And just speaking life and just celebrating recovery and having people there to support that.
Okay. And Katie, you are the director of the National Council on Drug and Alcohol Dependence, or Alcohol and Drug Dependence.
Yeah.
Did I get it right?
It's a long thing to say, right? We're the Juno affiliate.
Okay.
And at NCADD Juno, we provide outpatient treatment services for adults and youth. And we also provide education, some programming in the schools. And we also, throughout the years, we've often brought different trainers to town and speakers to raise awareness about addiction.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And tell us more about the Juno recovery community as a whole. Who are some of the people that are involved, and what all is your mission?
Yeah, so the Juno recovery community is a group of, there's about 12 of us people who are in recovery. And we formed last March. We were pretty inspired by a gentleman who came to town. His name is John Schinholzer, and he will also be at Recovery Fest. John Schinholzer and his wife, Carol McDade, are two people who are in recovery. They opened an organization called McShin Foundation, where they have a peer support model, and they provide sober, supportive living for people. Anyway, they're featured in a film titled The Anonymous People. And we had several screenings in the last year of this film at the Gold Town Theater, and it was a packed house every single time.
It's amazing.
It's a really great film. So anyway, we brought John up to Juno to help us raise some awareness and educate the community about addiction. And after his visit with us here in the community, there were a group of like 12 of us who were inspired, and it was our plan just to come together, just to start meeting regularly and support each other through authentic peer support, just by coming together and doing something, whether it be go out on a hike or share food or just meet at NCAD's conference room, which is where the meetings have been taking place. We plan events to help raise awareness about addiction and recovery in Juneau, and this was the first event that we identified would be probably a good start, the first event being Recovery Fest.
Right.
So, I mean, that's basically who we are and what we're doing right now. It's just, it's all volunteer people in recovery. We're getting support from NCAD, the organization that I work for, but we're just pretty much grassrootsy, just people coming together, like-minded people.
Yeah, okay. I was just going to say, I was really drawn to the recovery community. Well, obviously, I'm in recovery. But it was just that after watching the film, The Anonymous People, it really showed me where my passion was to really speak out about recovery, because we hear so much about the addiction side of it, and we've lived it. But to really speak out about the recovery part, and like Katie was saying, there's thousands of people right here in Juneau, but you don't hear about them, you know, you don't see them physically. And so Recovery Fest to me is really exciting, because I'm hoping it's going to start that dialogue and people that can speak out and not feel like, you know, not have that shame or guilt or feel like there's a lot of stigma attached to that, and just start really celebrating that, because it's very important.
Healthy activities, healthy social gatherings like mm-hmm. the one you're going to have on Saturday
right.
that are alcohol and drug-free,
mm-hmm.
filled with community, family, fun.
Yeah, that and sounds. Focus on the positive, right? Like,
right.
I look forward to people coming to celebrate the hard work that they've done to change their lives and make this transformation and give back to the community and show that, you know, they have accountability and they're taking responsibility and they're trying to reconnect and reestablish trust and relationships. You know, so much of what we see in our own community in the media is negative about addiction. You know, I think everybody's quick to report on the bad, horrible things that happen when people are in the depths of their addiction.
Right.
But do we ever celebrate the good things that happen? You know, when
after.
People, yeah, afterwards, when they do get well and they get good jobs like me and Kara have, you know, and are doing good in the community. You know, we
right.
want to focus on that and celebrate that.
That sounds excellent. And to meet you two in person, or to meet other people who are part of the Juneau recovery community,
mm-hmm.
you can go to Sandy Beach this Saturday from noon to 7.
Yes.
You said it's free, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Food, games,
awesome
live
food.
Music, poetry slam, guest speakers.
Yes.
Bring a lawn chair.
Yeah.
And just sit back.
Sunscreen, maybe.
Yeah.
Awesome.
We'll have a bonfire. And
yeah.
It's a tobacco,
crazy, wild people.
It's a tobacco-free event. I do want to say that.
Okay.
Yeah. No smoking.
Okay. Well,
but still come.
Karen, Katie, it's been very nice talking to you, and I hope you have a great event on Saturday.
Thank you.
Awesome, thanks.
Uh-huh.
This is KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. We rebroadcast on translators K276 AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269 AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K201 AM in Gustavus, K220 BT in Hoonah, and K210 AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, KTOO is on GCI Cable, on digital channel 871. We're also online at ktoo.org. Support for national programming on KTOO comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Thanks for tuning in to a Juno Afternoon today here on Monday, August 18th, 2014. Tomorrow, Ken Fix will be your host. We'll talk with Karen Fortwängler about this Saturday's Helping Hands Dinner and Auction. We'll hear about Saturday's fundraiser for the Dolly Parton Imagination Library. We'll hear about this week's Alaska Design Forum presentations on 3D printing. And new Juno School Superintendent Mark Miller will be here to introduce himself and highlight next week's first day of school. Plus, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, Music, and more Tuesday at 3 p.m. right here on KTOO News. If you miss a Juno Afternoon or want to hear it again, you can find it in the local programs link on our homepage, www.ktoo.org. Tune in to K2 News tonight at 7 for storytelling on Telling Tales with Miss G. And at 8, it's live coverage of the primary elections. Here's All Things Considered.